Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey, Holly.
Hey, Dave.
Welcome to the What Difference Does It Make podcast.
What's going on today?
Well, today's a day. How are you doing? Today's a day.
Wow.
Yes. All right. I'm doing well. I am doing well.
Okay.
How are you doing?
I'm good because I forgot. It was 5 minutes till showtime when I realized, oh my God, I got to prep myself for our big talk today.
So you have a lot of good info that you called in 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Been planning this episode for a little bit of time. During our talks with many different people, we touch on different topics. And lately, with a number of our guests, we've talked about John Lennon because it has been, this will be the 40th anniversary of his assassination. And so we thought it would be a good opportunity to kind of talk about John Lennon.
I've been kind of dreading this episode and looking forward to it. And I've been, you know, reading a lot, and it kind of brought back a lot of, you know, a lot of memories. And having just visited New York a few weeks ago, and I stood in front of the Dakota for a little while, tried to get some of my, some John Lennon mojo.
Yeah, a lot of people do that. I do that. Go through Strawberry Fields and, you know, it's amazing because Yoko still lives there.
And,
you know, that's, I don't know if I, I don't know. It's tough to leave a place like the Dakota if that's where you're living. But I would also imagine that that's a tough place to be at, even 40 years removed.
I would think so too, but she obviously stayed there for, you know, for her own reasons. And I didn't realize as I was looking at information about the Dakota, how many celebrity, you know, personalities, famous people have lived there over the years and how many were rejected. Since it's a co-op, there were a bunch rejected by the board. It's pretty amazing, but I guess you can see it. The building does appear to be pretty regal on the Upper West Side of New York.
Well, spill the beans. Who's not appropriate for the Dakota?
Surprisingly, Melanie Griffith and Antonio Banderas.
Ugh, who wants them to live there? Weird. That is strange. Okay, who else? I wonder what the reasons were.
I do too. It's
those boards are tough, from what I understand. Or, you know, it's like college admissions.
It is, and I know a co-op. You know, I know that they're very particular. So the board rejected them, and the guy who tried to sell his ownership to them expressed his disappointment with the way the building seems to be changing. And he had told, I guess, the New York Times in an interview, what's so shocking is that the building is losing its touch with interesting people. More and more, they're moving away from creative people and going towards people who just have the money. Mm. So some of the other personalities, you might be surprised, maybe not so much. And
is this a BuzzFeed thing? You may be surprised. Click to follow.
Yes. No. So Gene Simmons was rejected, Billy Joel, and Carly Simon.
That's odd. I'm actually surprised that they took in John Lennon, because at the time he was fighting for citizenship. Do you know when they moved in? When did they move into the Dakota?
They moved in 1973.
He was given his U.S. resident alien registration green card on the bicentennial of the American Revolution, July 4th, 1976. He was also informed that he would be eligible to apply for U.S. citizenship in 1981. So there you go.
So they did let him into the building without a green card.
Yeah. It says, So Yoko Ono, a Japanese citizen, was granted permanent resident status in 1973, and the couple's son, Sean, is an American citizen, having been born in New York. Mm-hmm. At the time they moved in, he wasn't even a U.S. citizen, and they let him in, which is crazy when you think about it.
Back at the time, if you believe, you know, the observation of the guy who tried to sell his apartment to John Lennon and Yoko Ono, they were moving more towards money and less toward creative types like John Lennon. At the time that John Lennon and Yoko Ono moved in, there were probably a lot more creative people in the building.
I guess so. And then these creative people ruined everything.
Wanted to go for the money. Hey, do you know why it was called the Dakota?
No. What happened? Why?
this is the stuff that interests me.
Yeah.
It's funny.
You are spiraling. Go down the rabbit hole. Go ahead.
I did go down the rabbit hole. Yeah. But also because since I was just there and I wonder if the building would be as interesting if you didn't know the history of it, but there's so much more depth to it when you're standing there because it, and this was the according to the manager of the building in it, he said it probably, so we don't know for sure, it was called the Dakota because it was so far west and so far north, and comparing it to the Dakota Territory because it was considered so remote. And I guess at the time at Central Park West and 72nd, it was considered sparsely inhabited and remote from the rest of Manhattan, which is crazy to think about now.
Right. Who would want to live there? It is the Dakotas. It's crazy. That's funny. But anyway, we are talking about John Lennon.
Yes, we are. We went to the Dakota, which is significant, obviously, but yes.
Well, so where were you?
I was 15, you were probably 14. And I know that Monday Night Football was on in my house. It was pretty much always on in my house. I can't remember exactly, but I am certain. And, you know, whether I'm conjuring up this vision or it's really true, I must have been in my room probably doing homework. I mean, 15, you're in high school, right? High school or?
Yeah, I was on the phone.
You were? Do you remember who you were talking to?
I have no idea who I was talking to, but I remember my dad coming in and telling me because he was watching Monday Night Football. And I was just then becoming a big fan of the Beatles. I think I was in my final year in junior high.
Yeah.
And I had a good friend that we used to like quiz each other on Beatles trivia back then. So, I mean, I was just kind of getting into the fandom because there is so much to absorb with the Beatles. It was weird hearing that, but it was also as being a 14-year-old guy, I didn't really understand what 40 meant. It seemed like that was old. I don't know what 40, you know, what that age is, you know, like that's like, oh, okay. Well, you know, he was 40. But I think Elvis had died at 42. You know, I assume that's when rock stars started dying off. Was at that age?
Those are the elderly, right? Yeah.
But it was something that really affected me.
Yeah, but it's even being a fan, as I was also, I was a big Beatles fan. I don't think at that age you're connecting the implication of what just happened with the music that is such a big part of your life. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because maybe it was a little bit less for us at that age about the personalities of the band. I mean, I was, you know, I love them and Paul McCartney, you know, the heartthrob, but I don't know. It was almost separate. You know, this was a personality that was assassinated, but this was the music you loved. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is. And as a teenager, or just, you know, just super young, you don't really, as you touched on it, you don't kind of grasp the implications of the global implications of what just happened and, you know, how tragic it is. You start, as you get older, you start thinking about, wow, what if John Lennon was alive? What would he think of the internet? Or I would imagine later, like I was saying, boy, you know, I bet you Bono and John Lennon would be best friends. And, you know, it's just, because Bono suddenly became, you know, started to become, you know, like this John Lennon type rock star.
Figure. Yeah.
You know, getting socially active and all that. It's a shame that John Lennon's not around because, you know, you would imagine that he would be a part of Live Aid. You know, he would be a leader of social causes and, you know, things that meant a lot to him in the 70s and the 60s and, you know, and moved on. So obviously it's a huge tragedy and it had social implications. it was bad.
Just a tragedy.
Yeah,
it's bad. For a million reasons.
Right.
You know, I was also thinking about, because we've seen the foot, even if you weren't watching it live, I was thinking about Frank Gifford and Howard Cosell having to talk about this and deciding whether to talk about it. Do you know anything about this? I read a little bit about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure it was a discussion whether it was appropriate or not. Because I know John Lennon was on Monday Night Football before. You could pull it up on YouTube and you could watch Howard interview John Lennon. Like, what do you think of the sport, football? It's like, well, this isn't the football that I'm used to, but I like it. You know, it's just him being John Lennon. Two cultural 70s icons talking to each other. That was kind of cool. So yeah. What was the discussion?
So I guess Rune Arledge, who was the president of sports at ABC at the time. And by the way, that interview, that interview where Howard Cosell interviewed John Lennon was in 1974. So Rune Arledge said that it was a game between the Patriots and the Dolphins, and there was less than a minute to go in the fourth quarter. And the Patriots it was looking like they were going to win. And Rune Arledge called Frank Gifford and Howard Cosell and told them about the shooting and suggested that they should be the ones to talk about it. And Howard Cosell was apprehensive first, but because he thought that the game should take precedence. And he also felt it wasn't their place to break such a big story. And it was Frank Gifford who convinced him otherwise, and because the significance of the event was greater than the finish of the game. And so I read a transcript, started with 30 seconds left in the fourth quarter, right after they had been informed. And it just, you know, that's such a, so I thought about that, you know, going back and forth. And I get that, you know, these are sportscasters, but this is the significance of the event outweighs who they are.
Yeah.
And they have this information and it's important, but could they give it the
gravitas?
The gravitas that it deserved. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Usually they would have the news. It wouldn't be their decision. That's kind of interesting because usually it was the network would break in and there would be the anchor. I mean, I'm sure they did that with the Kennedy assassination. They probably broke into the middle of whatever was going on.
What was going on when Walter Cronkite was, it was Walter Cronkite that was on.
Yeah. That was in the afternoon. So I'm sure there was soap operas or something, you know, on the network.
Actually, NBC did break into its East Coast feed of The Best of Carson, and it was in the middle of a Johnny Carson piece.
It's funny though that it's always attributed to ABC, Howard Cosell, and maybe because it was so unique, like that's what the nation was tuned into was Monday Night Football. So it was up to Howard Cosell to break this story.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
That is a heavy weight.
It is. And we were fortunate enough during our podcast episodes this year to talk with Mark Goodman and kind of discuss what happened at that time.
I will never, ever forget that night. Yeah, I was doing 10 to 2 on WPLJ in New York, and it was Jim Morrison's birthday. And we always did a little block of music on an artist's birthday. So I was in the middle, I was towards the end of the block, and it happened that the first notice I got, which was callers calling me saying, you know, Howard Cosell on ABC Football just made a mention that John Lennon had been shot. That was the first I heard from callers. Mm. And I'm in the middle of playing The Doors, The End. And a long song.
That's a lot, yeah.
To WABC, to the newsroom, and say, what's going on? And literally, it was coming across the wire that John Lennon, they didn't even report yet that he had died, just that he was coming, he had been shot. And literally, within 15 minutes, the report came across that he was dead. And, you know, we just went into playing Beatles music. And I was probably the second time. And last time that I cried on the air, it was, you know, what are you going to say? Just a shocking moment that you never expect. And by the next night I had gotten angry, that this could happen. But, we just went into Beatles music, and I was living right next door to the Dakota.
Oh man.
The Dakota. I lived at 15 West, and the Dakota was 1 West, but it's literally, I could look down into Lennon's apartment from my apartment. I'd never seen him in the neighborhood or anything, but that was, so I get off the air at 2 a.m. and I have to go home to that. And there's, you know, 1,000 people out front, flowers piled up in front of the Dakota, and police had blocked off the street. You know, they weren't letting you on the street unless you lived there. And I was pleased, despite what other local radio stations said, I was pleased that they were listening. The people there were blasting PLJ.
Yeah.
We had the bigger ratings.
Yeah. Still
to this day. NEW had the rep, but we had the ratings.
Well, that's the power of radio at the time. That's everyone tuned into, especially in something like that. You immediately turn on the radio to get all the latest and to kind of commiserate with everybody. All right. So we're talking John Lennon, and we're going to take a break right now.
Welcome back to the What Difference Does It Make podcast and our tribute and acknowledgement of the anniversary of John Lennon's assassination. Bob Gruen is the famed rock photographer and also the author of a new memoir, Right Place, Right Time, but also a good friend of the Lennons.
I mean, you took some family photos, and then you were entrusted in 1980 to kind of, you were at the record plant and you recorded like all this. It was secret, this Double Fantasy record.
Oh, yeah. When they were in the studio in the summer, it was a total secret. They didn't know where they were going with it, and they didn't want any interruptions, or they certainly didn't want any press about it. They wanted to be able to work without the distractions.
But you,
I remember I saw Yoko in June, and she said, you know, be ready for us to call you in July, but I can't tell you what it is until I call you.
Did it surprise you?
They were back in the studio? No, it didn't surprise me. The whole world was waiting for them, but I had actually gotten a postcard from John. It's in my John Lennon book, also out on Abrams, John Lennon, the New York Years, where he sent a postcard during the time he was raising Sean. And on the front is a picture of two people in a newspaper who are dead. And on the back was a picture of a bright sun and just a self-portrait of him and Yoko and Sean. And it just seemed like people in the news, you know, was a negative idea, and he and Yoko and Sean were in the bright sunshine of life. And that was a time when people were saying, where is John Lennon and why isn't he working? And that postcard really sums up why he wasn't working. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's prophetically true, because when he did come back, well, we all know what happened.
Yeah. You know, this is 40 years ago. Where were you at the time?
Well, I actually saw John and Yoko in the studio around December 6th. December 5th, and we were up all night Friday night until Saturday morning, actually Thursday night and Friday night, and I took some pictures of them on the sidewalk in front of the record plant on 44th Street Saturday morning, and John said, I'll see you later, and I was home in my darkroom Monday night developing those pictures, trying to finish up in a rush because I was actually supposed to see them that night and show them the pictures before I went to the Village Voice, and I got the phone call that he had been shot. And, of course, at first I thought shot doesn't mean dead. And then a friend of mine called up and said he heard on the TV that John was dead. And that was about the worst, most permanent thing I ever heard in my life. Because there's no way you can fix that. No way you can make that better. And since then, you know, it's such a sad ending to such a great story. But I try to think about the 40 years that we did have and that all the art and music that we got from John Lennon. And, you know, he did an interview in November, the month before he died, with David Sheff from Playboy magazine, which is a very extensive interview. And he talks about how he was feeling and what he learned while he was raising Sean. And he learned about a healthy diet. He learned, actually, unusually for John Lennon, he learned about delayed gratification. He learned about the responsibility and the joy that comes from taking care of your family. And he talks about all of that in the Playboy interview, and I'm bringing it up because that's going to be republished next month, I believe. Mm. And if people want to know about John Lennon, they can hear it from John Lennon in the Playboy interview rather than hearing other people talk about him. Of course, if you want to see John Lennon, my book, John Lennon and the New York Years, has some great pictures in it. And there are a lot of good stories in my new book, my autobiography here.
You portrayed that shift nicely. You talked about him discovering the macrobiotic diet and other healthy lifestyle choices like you're talking about. You did talk about it in the book a little bit.
Well, it's very important. He went from being a drunk rock star in the beginning to being a responsible parent by the end. You know, it was a real transformation, a real learning process.
It was very lovely, the way you portrayed the friendship and getting to know them and the family. Really enjoyed that.
Yeah. And you're still close with Yoko and Sean. So that's wonderful. We also are talking with Tim English, who was kind of like us, but a little bit older and was in college at the time. And so he's going to tell his story of what went on at the time when he was in college. He's got a book out.
It's called John Lennon 1980 Playlist, which is kind of a cool premise for the book. He researched the music that John Lennon was listening to in 1980, and he documents it for us. And it was very interesting to see. And it kind of gives you a little window into John Lennon's musical preferences, which was really nice.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Where were you in 1980, on December 8th, 1980?
I was in a dorm room in Providence, Rhode Island, watching Monday Night Football. And I was one of the worst nights of my life, just devastated because you heard Howard Cosell come on and deliver the news. And, you know, sometimes when they do these things, they say, well, he's been taken to the hospital and maybe he's going to pull through. And like, I believe that was the case with Michael Jackson. They said they'd taken him to the hospital. But in this case, Cosell just said, that's it. He's DOA at the hospital, you know. So it was just a heartbreaking, devastating thing, I think, for everybody who was around, but especially if you were a Beatles fan and a Lennon fan like I was.
Yeah, it's amazing that that's the same story for most Beatle fans. I mean, everyone discovered the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. Like, everyone was watching Ed Sullivan. It seems like everyone was at the time, 1980, all of America watches Monday Night Football. And that's really how everyone heard the story.
Absolutely. And one of the things I tried to do in the book is provide a little background on the world of 1980. And you know, it was a different world in a lot of ways, and some ways similar. But as far as communication went, I mean, you know, you mentioned two things. The Beatles on Ed Sullivan 64, where 75 million people watch. You know, the only TV show that gets that audience today is the Super Bowl. I mean, there's no, you couldn't replicate that even if you wanted to. It's just too much media and too many different options. Likewise, 1980, I mean, I don't know. We didn't have cable until a year or two later. If you wanted to, you were watching TV and you're looking for entertainment on Monday night, you had five or six choices, one of which was Monday Night Football. So, yeah, I mean, it was just a very different. If you wanted to hear a song that you loved at that time, you had to turn on the radio, either go out and buy it or turn on the radio and hope that they might play it sometime. So, you know, for younger readers especially, I tried to show, you know, how different it was back then. It's a long time ago now. 40 years.
Yeah. You did. I felt like you really did a good job in this book by bringing together history in general, music history, and John Lennon history. So I think you did create good perspective for younger readers.
Thank you. Well, it all goes together, doesn't it? I mean, what's going on in the world affects the music that's taking place, and sometimes vice versa. So you really have to have a little bit of understanding of both, I think, to really grasp what's going on in either of them.
So you were in a dorm room. You hear this news that, like, I would imagine that all college could suddenly just congregate into one certain area.
The guys I happened to be roommates with were more Southern rock type of guys, I might say. Whenever I hear a Marshall Tucker album, it takes me right back because I was just bombarded with Marshall Tucker and Charlie Daniels Band and the Allman Brothers. So they weren't impacted by the terrible news quite the way I was. So
Not the story I expected to hear.
Yeah.
Well, hey.
What college did you go to?
Providence College in Rhode Island. I remember the next day watching the news, and I think it was Frank Reynolds on ABC at that time, and he talked about John's assassination for like 5 minutes, and then it was on to the Middle East and Russia. And it was just like, wait a minute, you know? Yeah. What was going to go on after this? How can that be? You know, it just seemed like such a cataclysmic event at the time. And you know, it was a great loss, and I think we still feel it. I mean, all these years later, at least I do.
Yeah.
Did you own Double Fantasy when did the album come? The album came out in November.
Yeah, it came out November 17th. And no, the answer to your question is no. I had heard a couple of songs on the radio, and I remember hearing Starting Over, which was a single that came out in October. And I also remember hearing Woman on the radio. And, you know, it was just great to have him back. I mean, as I point out in the book, it was so unusual for an artist of John's caliber to just take 5 years off. It just wasn't done at that time. You know, typically John and everybody else would put out about an album a year. And the album, you know, it was a very short window there where people could listen to the album and not listen to it in light of what had happened to John. So I never really had that opportunity. I only heard it, you know, in the wake of his death. And of course, all the songs sort of take on that fact, you know, that you sort of relate them to that in some way. I mean, the irony of doing a song like Starting Over. As I point out in the book, it came out later, but the song Living on Borrowed Time, recorded that for the Double Fantasy Sessions. And now here he's recording a song called Living on Borrowed Time, and he's got 4 months to live. So, you know, there were certain songs that sort of foreshadowed this. It's kind of eerie.
Yeah, we're making lots of associations afterwards. I have to ask, what was the impetus for the book?
You have to write a book that you're really turned on by the subject. The books I write are all, you know, fact-checking and digging out facts. And it would be the worst job in the world if you weren't really turned on by the subject. So that makes it fun. But, you know, it's not really work if it seems like fun. And, you know, John has had so much written about him that trying to find a new way into this topic, into this life, was a challenge, I think, for any writer. But I thought it was really cool. You sort of place yourself in his shoes and listen to what he was listening to. And as I got further into the research, I realized that some of this music actually impacted some of the crucial decisions he made that year, particularly the decisions to go back to the recording studio, the decision to I could never figure out why he was back in the recording studio just a week or two after Double Fantasy had come out. And I kind of reveal that in the book, which I don't think many Beatle fans are aware of. I'll tell you guys, it was he found out that a DJ at the Peppermint Lounge in Midtown Manhattan, the really hip club of the day, was playing Yoko's song, Double Fantasy song, Kiss, Kiss, Kiss. And John was just thrilled with this news. He said, wow, isn't that cool? He said, she's finally getting the acceptance that I think she's deserved all these years. We need to put out a record specifically aimed at the Biscuits. And that was the impetus for him to go back in the studio and work on a track, Walking on Thin Ice, which had originally been recorded back during the summer. So John goes in and he overdubs some really cool guitar over that, you know, really adventurous work in the week before he was killed. So, you know, I kind of use the songs in some ways as a jumping off point to make, put out some new information for people or hopefully give an insight or two into what made John tick.
Also, as you mentioned in the book, you know, the B-52s were already kind of honoring Yoko Ono with Rock Lobster. It has definite Yoko Ono overtones in there.
John picked up on that right away. It's amazing that, and it was absolutely true. Kate Pearson and the B-52s were people that had picked up on Yoko's prior work earlier in the 70s. And that sort of scream that Kate Pearson does in Rock Lobster is right out of Yoko's work. And John hears that immediately. And he was thrilled with that. He said, wow, the world is finally catching up to what Yoko and I were doing with the Plastic Ono Band 10 years prior. And he said, now's our time. Now we got to get back in the studio. It's funny, though, because that song had been around for a while. The B-52s actually performed it on Saturday Night Live in January of 1980. But John really became aware of it in June 1980. And right away, he calls up Yoko and says, let's think about getting back to the studio. Get out the axe, get out the car. And sure enough, he gets back to New York at the end of July. And by the first week of August, he's in the studio recording Double Fantasy.
You painted a picture also of things that he might have been feeling during all this time. And while he's, you know, listening to this music, insecurities, which nobody really thinks about, and support of other artists, of his fellow Beatles, and also of Yoko. We know he was complex, but you painted a pretty complex picture of him, which was really, you know, nice to see.
Yeah, well, I don't pretend that I have any inside knowledge, but I do delve into what other people have said and what he said at the time about what he was going through. Mm-hmm. And he's certainly a complex guy. When he did his demos down in Bermuda for the songs that became part of Double Fantasy and Milk and Honey, he had all the secrecy around it when he presented them to his producer, Jack Douglas. It was like a Mission Impossible thing where he put them on a seaplane out of Manhattan, pulled them out to Long Island, and said, any word of this gets out at all, the project's off. He even told that to the musicians at the beginning. And why was that? Well, Jack Douglas said that he was afraid that he didn't have it anymore. This is John Lennon we're talking about, right? But he was very insecure and thought, you know, he'd been away for a long time. I mean, that was what to compare it to. I mean, like going away for a decade or more now, maybe. Yeah. But 5 long years, and we didn't know if the public was going to accept him, or especially if he still had his muse, so to speak, you know, his creative spark. And Jack Douglas was amazed at that because he thought all the songs were great. And a lot of them were, and you're right. He was insecure, which is, I guess, is part of being an artist and being creative. Yeah. That you're never quite sure if you're, you know, maybe making a fool of yourself or being a genius, or maybe there's a thin line. I don't know. But for somebody like John Lennon to be insecure, what hope is there for the rest of us?
Yes, a Beatle.
I'd say it's also true of his last live performance at Madison Square Garden with Elton John. He didn't want to jump up on stage. He didn't know how he was going to be received. And I think he lost a bet. I think Elton John and John Lennon made a bet about, whatever gets you through the night. If that made it to number one, he said he would jump up on stage. And I believe the story was, I mean, he did not want to go up on stage because he wasn't sure, like, what's, you know, how, How am I perceived
now?
He
said he got sick before. That that's how nervous he was about going up on stage. John did very few public appearances. I mean, he never did a concert for money after leaving the Beatles. You know, everything he did was either a one-off like that, or he played with Zappa at the Fillmore East, or charity things. That was not his last appearance, because he did something at one of the New York hotels the following spring for Sir Lou Grade, but that was his last one where you had paying customers, with Elton John. And it's interesting, I didn't know until Elton John wrote his book last year. He actually met up again with John in 1980 after the Elton Central Park concert in September, which was a huge deal, hundreds of thousands of people. And he actually sang John's Imagine that day. And he revealed in his book something I don't think anybody ever knew before, that he actually got together with John and Yoko for a brief period at a party after that show in Central Park in September.
That time between 75 and 80, it's like a little, almost a black hole. Obviously, he made some appearances and, he was still out and about on occasion. But for the most part, nobody really knows. You know, he was just a dad.
Pictures of him from that time at the time.
Right.
You know,
you could be off. He was literally off the grid, which is, for that time. It's crazy.
Yeah. But he was like he wasn't because he was traveling at that time. He went to Egypt. He went to Japan every summer from in those years, the last time being in 1979. He went to Hong Kong. David Bowie pops up a lot in my book. Hung out with John in Hong Kong in 1977. You can find a picture of that online. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody knew that at the time. But, as I show in the book, he didn't exactly renounce all of his rock star like activities. Sure. He didn't become a choir boy in 1975 when he became a dad again. As Bowie tells it, they were hanging out in Hong Kong, going to strip clubs and getting drunk at night, and other kind of bad boy type of things. So he was still having his fun. A cool story I found that Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo, this is 1977, before Devo had a record deal. John shows up. They've just done their show at the Maxis Kansas City Club, downtown New York. And a drunken John Lennon sticks his head in the car that Mark Mothersbaugh is sitting in after the show, singing Devo's song, Uncontrollable Urge, to him.
Yeah.
And he picked up on the Yeah Yeah thing, was sort of a Beatles tribute. And actually, the beginning of that song, if you listen to it, it's not similar to I Want to Hold Your Hand, the guitars.
Mm-hmm.
So, he was. In one of his interviews, he said, no, we never went to a movie or to a show or anything. You know, Carole King in her memoir said that she was at a taxi driver, of all things, screening with him. And then they later got together after that. Mm. But so he was, he was just, like you said, off the grid sort of, but he was not, he was still out doing things.
But yeah, as you mentioned in the book, he's paying close attention to his peers and what they're putting out. And I was kind of curious. Paul McCartney, Paul McCartney 2 was like a real experimental album. And so I was kind of interesting what Lennon's take was on an album like that.
Now we're getting Paul McCartney 3 after 40 years.
Right.
So it's amazing. A lot of the artists, a lot of those contemporaries of his are still around, and still doing their thing. Coming Up by Paul McCartney, a big hit in 1980, that was an important song to John. By two separate accounts, if people happened to be driving in a car with him that spring, when that song came on the radio, John was really taken with it. He really liked the song. And if you listen to the first song John recorded, one of the first songs he wrote when he got to Bermuda, a song called I Don't Want to Face It. It's very similar musically and actually lyrically to Coming Up. They both have that same sort of guitar sound, and they both ask the question, you say you're looking for this, you say you want to do that. It's almost like an answer song. Mm-hmm. To Coming Up. Unlike in the UK, the studio version of Coming Up was the number one hit. In the US, it was the Live in Glasgow version, if you remember, that became the number one hit. John preferred the studio version. He called it the freaky deaky version. And Robert Hilburn of the LA Times asked him in an interview in October. He said, were you surprised that Paul did a song so that he's doing such good work? And John said something really touched me. He said, how? He said, how can you be surprised by your brother?
Mm. Yeah.
You know, somebody you know so well, it doesn't surprise me that he's doing great work.
You talked a little bit about his initial reaction to Queen and then his kind of becoming a, you know, becoming a fan. What was the turning point for John, which in your estimation?
Well, really, of the songs that really had an impact on John, Queen's Crazy Little Thing Called Love would be one of them. Because he hears that song, it was the number one hit in March or February in the U.S. John hears it, and he hears him doing Elvis Presley. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an unQueen-like song, kind of a throwback to the 50s rockabilly, a great song that Freddie Mercury wrote in 10 or 15 minutes, supposedly, on his guitar. But John picked up on that, and he said, you know, maybe it's my time again. You know, if stuff like, they're getting back into doing that Elvis thing, maybe it's my time to come back again. And of course, if you listen to Starting Over, he's basically, as one of his session guys said, he's basically doing Elvis on that song. Well, you know, all that, you know, sort of tongue-in-cheek, but sort of not. I mean, he just loved all that music. But that song, Crazy Little Thing Called Love, along with Rock Lobster, along with Coming Up, really one of the key songs that in John's life in 1980, in that it influenced him to maybe it's time to get back into making music.
Okay, so that was a pretty good F. What do you think, Holly?
Oh, it was really great to talk about John Lennon. Very heartwarming, depressing, any adjective you can come up with. But it was an enjoyable episode, and those were I really enjoyed talking to those guys.
Yeah, I wouldn't even say depressing. It's just it's wonderful that we got to experience John Lennon and his music and his life. We have some people to share those memories with us, and of, you know, and there's always the music. We think positively about that, and you know, and that's our takeaway.
And that we get to share our memories of John Lennon with our children, with the next generation.
Exactly. It's always nice to hear everybody's perspective on a topic that we all love.
Yeah, definitely. And thank you to our listeners. Thanks for listening to What Difference Does It Make podcast.
Yes, please follow us. We're on Facebook at What Difference Does It Make podcast.
Instagram and Twitter at WDDIM podcast. And you can also check out some behind the scenes stuff on our YouTube page. Just search for What Difference Does It Make.
Also, we have a monthly newsletter, WDDIMpodcast.com. So please sign up for that.
And check us out on our social media sites, because we are going to have some giveaways in the month of December.
Well, that sounds exciting. All right. Also, I should remind everyone that we have a Spotify playlist of Lennon 1980. This is all the music that he was influenced by to help him during the recording of Double Fantasy. Tim English put this together, and so we slapped all these songs on there, and it's quite a varied list. Spotify will have a link for it on our website, wddimpodcast.com. So thank you again for listening, and until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.